Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. President Trump on Monday told Americans not to press pause on the economy, saying he wants to get it back on track by Easter.
America will again and soon be open for business, very soon, a lot sooner than 3 or 4 months that somebody was suggesting. A lot sooner. We cannot let the cure be worse than the problem itself. We're not going to let the cure be worse than the problem.
On Tuesday, Ohio Governor Mike DeWine said he and the president have the same goals, but different timelines.
The fact is that we save our economy. We save our economy by first saving lives. And we have to do it. And we have to do it in that order.
Meanwhile, Congress has a bipartisan $2 trillion economic relief package ready for a vote, news of which on Tuesday sent the stock market shooting up. So what's an ordinary investor planning a retirement to think about all this? Chris Farrell is a senior economics contributor to Marketplace, an American Public Media business and economic program that airs daily on 89.7. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Well, thank you for having me.
I know what people, you know, I do personal finance shows pretty regularly, and we always hear the think, you know, long term, don't look at the short term, except that we're all riveted on the short term. And we, meanwhile, big shots are dumping their stock. So what are people to think?
So for the ordinary person, let the institutional investors, the big shots, do what they're going to do. Let them play in the market. Let them try and figure out what is the right price level for the stock market and the bond market. But that's not the same thing as saying don't do anything. And I think for your listeners, what you really want to think about is, where is my household risk? And what can I do to lower my household risk? Now, for most people, it actually isn't what's going on in their 401k or their 403b, because they might have some time to retirement. But maybe you're carrying too much debt. Maybe you have some credit card debt. Maybe you're in your mid-50s. And we know that if you lose your job in your mid-50s, it's very hard to get another job. So I start focusing on my household, think about where your risk is, and then take some steps to attack that risk, and then you come out of this in a much stronger position.
So play it closer to home then. You can't control what's going on.
You can't.
You know, I hope I don't come across as asking the same question 10 different ways, but when we choose our funds, when we choose a financial advisor, they're telling us they're going to do this and that. What kind of control do we have over looking at what they're doing and checking up on what they're doing?
Well, you should be checking up. If you have a financial advisor, you should be on the phone with that financial advisor. You should be in contact with that financial advisor. You should be asking them just the question that you're asking. And you should be saying, okay, why shouldn't I sell? Now, that financial advisor, by the way, is going to have some good reasons. They're going to look at your portfolio and they're going to say, here's what I think you should do. But you should be definitely asking those questions. It's also important to realize that compared to 2008, 2009, when we had the last big just bear market plunge in the stock market, more and more workers who have a 401k or a 403b are in what are called target date funds. And a target date fund, all you do is you say, I'm going to retire in 2045. You just pick a date. And then it automatically goes from lots of equities when you're younger and more conservative as you get older. So in a sense, it's already automated. And this is why many people don't even touch their retirement plans, because the process is automated through these target date funds.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about, you know, the economics of the coronavirus pandemic, what it means to the rest of us. My guest is Chris Farrell. He's a senior economics contributor for Marketplace from American Public Media. You listen to Marketplace every day on 89.7 NPR News. If you have a question or comment for Chris, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We've heard about the federal lawmakers who dumped stocks after telling their constituents not to worry about anything. They're dumping large amounts from what's been reported. What do we need to pay attention to about that, besides the possible possible illegality of it?
Yeah, I mean, and I can't judge the illegality of it, right. But I think that it's wrong. It's immoral. It was the wrong thing to do. If you were going to take those sort of actions, you're a public figure, you're a congressperson, you're a senator, you should have gone out there and said, hey, this is what I've heard, this is what I've learned, and by the way, I'm going to sell some stocks because I think that this is a really worrisome situation. That's not what they did. So it's hypocritical, and it is really deeply wrong. And one of the things that I do want to emphasize for a lot of listeners, you know, if you're in a situation where you have a fair amount of money, and you have a secure job, you know, one of the ways that the jargon is, are you a stock? Or are you a bond? So if you're a bond and you have a fairly secure job, and probably the classic example of that is a tenured university professor. And, you know, this is a time to be thinking about, well, maybe I might want to buy some stocks. So some good companies are, you know, they're selling a lot cheaper than they were a couple of months ago. But most of us, we're more like a stock. Our jobs are risky. Our income is risky. This isn't a time for us to be taking a big risk. This is a time for us to be lowering our risk. So a lot of the answers about what to do depend on, are you a stock or are you a bond?
You know, there's also been a message put out there, although it's impossible, well, not with the online world that we live in now, but all things being equal, it's impossible to think about spending money and putting money into the economy when you're also trying to, you know, consider what your household risk is. Are you carrying too much debt? That kind of a thing. What kind of message should we look for out there?
So, you know, there's always this sense that in a downturn, you shouldn't make any really big adjustments. But this time is different, right? I mean, this time it's a public health emergency, and we're trying to suppress economic activity in order to suppress the virus, which is why the money that's coming in from the federal government with the fiscal plan, I'm assuming it's going to get passed, the $2 trillion that you mentioned at the beginning, they'll help people pay their bills. Because as Larry Summers, former Treasury Secretary, economist, put it, we're cocooning the economy. But by the way, your mortgage check, your rental bill, you know, those bills are still ongoing. So that's a lot of what the government is trying to do with its fiscal stimulus. So this is one of those times where it's not about, you know, get out there and, you know, let's try to get America back to work. That's the goal in the longer term. But in the short run, we're trying to suppress economic activity, which is a very unusual situation for any economy.
In the last downturn, the banks were at the center of it. Now, a lot of banks have a lot of cash on hand, and they're in a position to actually help. What's your sense about that?
I think it's a very different situation. And by the way, a lot of the regulations, a lot of the rules that have been chipped away over the past decade, they really are helping out. So the fact of the matter is banks are in a better situation. And if you think about where's the epicenter of concern, it's not the household as much. The concern about the household is people are losing their jobs, and it's terrible that people are losing their jobs. But the household financial situation is fairly reasonable. The concern is corporate America went on a huge borrowing binge, and that's where a lot of the current concern is right now about, as this economic crisis continues, how much of it is going to show up in the corporate credit market. And that's why the Federal Reserve is being so aggressive. And the Federal Reserve is saying, we're not only going to buy U.S. Treasuries, we're not only going to buy mortgage debt securities, we're also going to buy municipal debt and corporate debt in order to keep the gears of the finance system working until we can come out of this period of suppression.
So how does that change the value of the corporate debt, though?
Right. So it just, to a large extent, what it does is it just simply keeps the corporate debt at a certain value, so you're not as worried about companies going into bankruptcy.
Okay.
And so that's really what you're trying to do, is prevent a lot of companies from going into bankruptcy. And so this really will help to deal with that. The other thing that you really want to do is you want to just try to get as many employers as possible not to lay off their workers. I think this is where we should really take some lessons from Europe that are really striking about how aggressive some of the European countries are in paying for people's wages in return for employers not laying off the workers. We have some of that in this fiscal stimulus bill, and I think that's a really good move. We've also, which is really good, devil's in the details, but it looks like unemployment insurance is being expanded to a lot of freelancers and gig economy workers, the sort of 1099 economy that traditionally is excluded from unemployment insurance. So these are some really good measures, assuming that it gets passed, which I am assuming.
And still, though, the unemployment rate is going up so fast, even want the states to report them on a report it on a daily basis. I guess we're waiting until tomorrow when the federal numbers come out. What do you think that does do with what we're dealing with now? I mean, people have already been laid off.
Right. I mean, this is an unemployment crisis. And so what, 2 months ago, the unemployment rate, 3.5%. Right, half century low. Now the unemployment rate has at least doubled, and you have people like the head of the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis, James Bullard. He's a very sober individual, and he's saying, "Look, we could see unemployment rates of 30%. A lot of numbers that are out there coming into Wall Street is saying we could see unemployment rates of 20%. This is why you have this $2 trillion fiscal stimulus. This is why the Federal Reserve is moving as fast as it is. This discussion right now that's been going on, and the speed of the discussion compared to the discussion back in 2008, it's really remarkable how fast the system is moving right now. And it's because of unemployment.
In Ohio, they never dealt with the shortfalls of the state unemployment compensation trust fund. This has been an ongoing issue. They had to borrow a ton of money from the federal government and pay interest on it. They just got that paid back, I think, last year. And now they're going right back into it again without ever having dealt with the inadequacies in the first place.
Yes, and I don't think Ohio is the only state. The good news is they've increased the amount of unemployment insurance. They've increased the length of unemployment insurance. And this is when the federal government does need to step up, and it is stepping up. Look, people who have lost their jobs, they need that unemployment insurance. And by the way, and I don't know if Ohio has done this, but you don't, here in Minnesota, there's no waiting period. A number of states have waived the waiting period. You lose your job, just file right away. Mm-hmm. And they're going to try and get it to you as fast as possible.
Well, we're going to continue our conversation with Chris Farrell, senior economics contributor to Marketplace. And coming up, we're going to hear from the editor and publisher for the Retirement Income Journal. If you have questions or comments, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The response by the markets to the announcement that a relief package is on its way was good news on Tuesday, but the pandemic is far from over, and so is the worry of investors whose retirement savings are tied up in stocks and bonds. We're talking about what COVID-19 pandemic portends for the economics of the everyday household. Still with us is Chris Farrell, senior economics contributor for Marketplace, which airs daily on 89.7. Joining us is Carrie Pector. He's editor and publisher of Retirement Income Journal. Welcome to the show, Carrie.
Hi, Ann. It's great to join you.
What are the questions you're getting from? Now, you mostly write for the industry, right?
That's right, for financial advisors and for the people who build mutual funds and annuities.
And what are they talking about?
There's two things. The advisors are all talking to their clients and trying to calm them down. The clients at times like this, it's funny, they expect their advisors, one of the things that people expect from their advisors is to have told them in advance of this kind of thing happening. That's one thing they expect, and that's one thing that advisors constantly tell them that they can't provide. And in this case, hopefully people... Well, I'll give you one example. I talked to an advisor the other day. He has a fairly new client. The client owns a business, is 62 years old, and is expecting to sell the business about 3 years, and he considers that business kind of a safe asset. At the same time, because he considered that a safe asset, he had $700,000 in stocks in his 401k. And, of course, that went down to about $450,000 or $500,000, depending on what kind of exactly what he had. Mm-hmm. And so he was having a conversation with his client and telling his client that, of course, you know, as Chris said, you don't sell your stocks at a time like this. You have to just wait until it comes back a little. And then he said he's going, once the market comes back a little, he will start to sift some of that money back into a safer asset, to the point where his client then feels comfortable. And then they'll have to review, well, how safe an asset is the business? What do we do? But most advisors are sending out letters to their clients right now saying, relax. What you don't want to do, here's a distinction that I don't think many people really have top of mind. When the assets go down, you don't lose shares. You still own all those shares. It's not as if the number of shares went down. It's the market price went down. And the market price is something that's a little bit of a fairy tale. It can be, you know, it can change. And so, but you've got your shares, and in the long run, the ownership of those shares is what you want. The market will eventually come back.
When we talk about the dive that it took over the last 3 weeks, they say things like it's wiped out the last 3 years of the, you know, market gains.
Right.
And a lot of it's in terms of the Trump president administration. But you can wipe it out in a matter of a few days. Can you gain it back at the same pace?
The answer to the question is partly, do you want to gain it back?
Okay.
Was the market, was it correctly priced, or was the market just juiced up by the low, very low interest rates, and do we want to continue to juice it up? We don't want to put things, I'm going kind of above my pay grade in terms of public policy, but do we really want to put things back the way they were if they weren't stable?
Okay. Chris Farrell, well, let me ask Chris Farrell about that, because, you know, we know that the president, in a really, in my experience, an unprecedented way, pressuring the Fed to lower the interest rates, the Fed has responded, whether it's not to the president or not, as I guess is debatable. But is that the wise thing to necessarily be doing?
In terms of the Fed lowering its interest rate, I think the Fed has really done well. I mean, I think the Fed has signal strongly to the market that the Fed is open for business. The printing press is open if that's necessary. They're going to stand behind a lot of the credit facilities that are out there, the money market funds, the commercial paper market, all jargon terms for this sort of short-term credit that this system really runs on. So I think the Fed has really done a terrific job. Now, what the Fed is also telling us is that there's a real risk that this economy is going to really slow down. It already has really slowed down. The kind of debate about whether or not we're going into recession is over. It's just how deep will this recession be? Mm-hmm. There are even legitimate people who are saying, you know, we have the prospect of a depression. Now, the reason why I say legitimate people is whenever the economy turns down, there's always this chorus that says a depression is coming, and you don't pay any attention to them. But when you're talking about the prospect of 20% unemployment rates, it is reasonable to assume that, you know, this is pretty bad and the Fed has acted responsibly. I think the Fed has actually done a terrific job in recent weeks.
What about the pressure that the president's putting on it, though? That seems really different to me.
Oh, it absolutely is different. I mean, all presidents, there's a certain decorum. Yeah. And, you know, all presidents want lower interest rates. I mean, by definition. But there's a decorum. And no, I think what Trump did was, President Trump did in terms of pressuring the Federal Reserve was absolutely wrong and counterproductive. And but at this point in time right now, I think no one sees the Fed operating under the president's direction. What they see the Fed doing is using its mandate to support the economy. It is actually what it is doing is what central bankers are supposed to do. It is now truly the lender of last resort to the U.S. economy.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about personal finances today, what the macroeconomy means to the microeconomy of your household. You just heard Chris Farrell. He's senior economics contributor for Marketplace. It's an American public media program you hear every day on 89.7 NPR News. And also with us, Kerry Pechter. He is editor and publisher for Retirement Income Journal. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Yeah, Kerry Pechter.
Ann, I'd like to give the flip side to what Chris said. Because I talk a lot to the insurance industry, and I don't think that the Fed has done a good job at all. I think that they were raising rates in December of rates were still going up as of December 18, and I think that they should have resisted the pressure from people in the markets, and they should have resisted the president and kept rates going up. Here's why: these low rates are not free. While they help the stock market, they have really, really hurt all kinds of safe assets and annuity products, and given people no place to go except for the when you lower rates to zero, you give insurance companies no room to make money, and that means they cannot offer any products, which means they're unable to, right now they are unable to offer the products that older people need the most, which is bonds and annuities. And the insurance company for some reason keeps very quiet about this. But this low-rate environment has destroyed it. We should have stayed the course on interest rates and balance. That's what I meant by not wanting to rebuild the house in the same instability that it was in before. And that's what lowering the rates to zero. It's just delaying another reckoning.
Chris Farrell.
Oh, well, I mean, I think if we're having this discussion back in December, we'd have a very legitimate debate about that. I think at the time when you're dealing with the unemployment rate skyrocketing, you know, as you mentioned, Ann, and, you know, the unemployment claims IRF are increasing and small businesses under enormous threat and you're worried about the credit markets, I think that debate back in December is over with for now.
So let's talk about bonds and annuities, Kerry Pechter. Why are they so desirable for older retirees?
Well, just simply because they need safety. They need bonds, either they need a supply of bonds for their expenses over the next couple of years, because let's say that you're retired and you're holding a lot of stocks. According to traditional financial advice, if you're taking 4% of your stock and bond portfolio out every year, and when something like this happens, when the market goes down 30%, your advisor will say, well, you need to spend 30% less this year. Well, people don't like that, and they want to spend the same amount, which means they have to sell some things that they don't want to sell. But if they have a cache of bonds, enough money in bonds to last them 3 to 5 years, then they don't have to go into the equities. And as far as the annuities go, annuities provide the kind of pension that people don't have right now. For instance, I bought an annuity that provides me with an income for 10 years from starting when I retire, and and with Social Security, it will cover all of our expenses for the first 10 years. I'm also invested in stocks, but I know that I do not have to sell any of those stocks for the first 10 years after I retire. So simply because you have different kind of risks and you need different kind of safe tools as a retiree, that's why those are become important.
Chris, there fewer and fewer people have them, but there are still a significant number of baby boomers who do have pensions, right? Those are like annuities, all things being equal, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, if you think about the person who's still getting a pension, whether it's a state and local government pension or from a large company, it's essentially as if you're still getting your paycheck, or you're getting a paycheck. You're not getting the same amount of money, but it's like, you know, you get it once a month or however it's divided. Usually it's monthly, and monthly your paycheck shows up even though you're no longer working. So that's a way of thinking about it.
But, Kerry Pechter, fewer and fewer people have things like pensions. They have to make that decision to buy into an annuity if they want to go that way. But a lot of people, you know, are poo-poo annuities. They think that people are over-invested in them, that it doesn't let their money grow properly.
Well, you have to understand that annuities are kind of the opposite of investments. When you buy an investment, you're buying risk. You're embracing risk because you want to get the upside. When you buy an insurance product like an annuity or life insurance, I guess, but an annuity in this case, you're selling risk to an insurance company. So that the you're selling risk, and there's a fee for that. And so you can't compare the investments and the insurance because they're kind of opposite. And when you get into retirement, you need some kind of mix between the two because there's certain synergies and certain stabilities that you achieve by having both.
Now, when I listen to you guys talk, I mean, it seems like I got it all down pat, but it's like a full-time job. It's exhausting to think about what you guys kind of do every day and what you do for a living, Kerry and Chris. You know, people don't even, the fact of the matter is people simply don't have that kind of relationship. Most people don't have that kind of relationship with their financial advisor, if they even have a financial advisor. And when you talk about kind of getting your household in order, Chris Farrell, at the outset, whether you're carrying too much debt or not, what does that mean to carry too much debt?
Sure. So, you know, one way of cutting through all this, and let's just for the moment, we're looking at a household that's nearing retirement. So if you're near retirement, you have a pretty good idea about what your expenses are. I mean, someone who's 25 years old, 30 years old, thinking about what are my expenses going to be in retirement, that's just an unrealistic calculation. Mm-hmm. But if you're in your late 50s, you got a pretty good idea what your expenses are going to be. So you can look at your expenses, and then you think of, okay, how do I think about tiding myself over these periodic, because they do happen, traumas in the economy and in the stock market. So there's various theories. One is the annuity that Kerry is talking about. Another, what's called kind of like the bucket theory. You put about enough cash into a bucket your checking account or your savings account, and it can meet a year or 2 or 3 years worth of expenses. And then you have your investments above that. So I actually think people can really cut through this on their own. And the thing is, the real key in a lot of this, when we're talking about American households, and you mentioned debt, for many American households, what really matters is entering your retirement years without debt. Getting rid of debt lowers your household risk. The other stuff, okay, that's like you say, a full-time job. But we all know getting rid of debt, particularly credit card debt, auto loans, and home equity loans, mm-hmm. really helps your balance sheet.
I want to turn real quick to Charles in London. You're on the air. Hi, Charles. Hi, Charles.
Hello, I had three questions. I'm sorry, I got to load you up. Number one, I heard an economist say that there's a possibility that because of the COVID-19 work stoppage, that some of these jobs might not exist on the other side as corporations make the decision to go viral or virtual or automated in that sense. And the other thing I had heard, is it true that there are no American-owned cruise line industries, and that these cruise companies are actually foreign-owned, even though there are a lot of American jobs that are tied to them. Uh-huh. And the third thing I wanted to ask, with the Fed pumping liquidity into the private banks, doesn't that give a good enough amount of capital for the big companies, which are very creditworthy, not the small companies, which definitely need a federal help, but the big companies, which are very creditworthy, to get their rescue or their surety from them rather than the American taxpayer? And again, I think NPR is doing God's work at this time, and I love you and thank you for it. I take my answer on the air.
Thank you, Charles. Thanks a lot for that. All right, so... I know this isn't exactly what we're talking about today, but I think he makes an interesting point about the jobs, maybe
it's
not existing on the other
point,
side.
Yes.
And I've been thinking about that a lot lately as I'm I'm coming into the office every day still, but there's only like maybe three of us here at a time.
That's right.
And I drive home, and even though there's still a lot of people on the roads, it's nothing like it was. I'm just thinking about what's going to change and how does that change the equation going forward if something like what Charles suggests, that the jobs might not be there on the other side when this is over with. Kerry Pector, do you have any feelings about that?
Yes. We're reaching a point where one of the things that I think that they've been struggling over with in Washington as they debate these bills is, you know, you have people who want the government to give money directly to people, and you have another group that wants to mediate this through the banks and do lending, and you have two really different ways of looking at the world and looking at the responsibility of the government. And so I think people need to pay so close attention to the details now and find out whether they're going to get loaned money, whether they're going to get their debts kicked down the road, or whether their debts are going to be forgiven. We have massive devil in the details things in these bills, which will determine whether or not the businesses stay healthy without employees or the businesses stay healthy with employees. The way these bills are constructed is going to have a big impact on whether those jobs are going to be there or not.
Chris Farrell.
So just a couple off of what he was saying, you know, one of the things I think that this is clarifying is there is a distinction in our social safety net between the W-2 employee, the employee, and the 1099 worker, the gig economy worker, the freelance worker. And, you know, and there's been a big debate about this. I think what this really says is, look, in an economy where sometimes people are employees, sometimes they're the 1099, which is off of the tax system, that distinction actually doesn't really help us. So we're going to cut through that. We have this thing about, are we going to do more of our jobs virtually? Well, what it's also really raised is the inequalities with internet access. And, you know, number of schools are dealing with this, where they have some students have good internet access at home and other students don't. So I think what this is going to do is some of these debates about the social safety net, what is a worker in an economy where people change jobs more often, in an economy where people are sometimes a W-2 worker, sometimes a 1099 worker, going to be able to work out of the home sometimes. It's going to reshape the future of work in the society. And part of that is going to be reshaping that social safety net for downturns just like this, because this is not the last pandemic.
We are going to take a break. Chris Farrell, are you staying with us?
Yes, I am.
Okay, great. Chris Farrell, senior economics contributor for Marketplace. You hear Marketplace every day on 89.7. And also with us, Carrie Pachter, editor and publisher for Retirement Income Journal. We'll be right back. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the COVID-19 pandemic and what it portends for everyday investors. Still with us, Chris Farrell, senior economics contributor for Marketplace. You hear that every day on 89.7. Joining us, Carrie Pachter, Carrie Pachter, editor and publisher of Retirement Income Journal. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Is this bear market different from others, Chris Farrell? There's the 2008 recessions, 9/11, 1987, 1929, historic dates in stock market history. Does it matter? Or do they differ?
Well, I think on one hand, yes. On the other hand, no. And I'm not trying to do the proverbial economist thing where you say, well, on the one hand, on the so it does not. It what seems so different about this is how fast it has happened, the speed at which this has happened. And what is different is the underlying cause. So this initially started out in the jargon of the sort of economic world as a supply shock. So it didn't matter if you were ordering more goods and services out of China, the factories were closed and you couldn't get those goods or services. Now it's become what we call also called demand shock, where people are losing their jobs and demand is falling. So this, the speed and the rapidity of the decline in the economy and the rise in the unemployment rate and the threat to small business is unusually fast, unusually quick, and it is both a supply and a demand shock. But if you're an investor and you're looking at the stock market, you can say, boy, it's another bear market. Stocks are being priced down. And everyone's trying to figure out what are they going to be worth in the future.
Now, I know the institutional investors are working for all of us, kind of, but individual investors, Carrie Pachter, it seems like it's going to widen a gap that we've been extremely concerned about for years now between the very poor and the very rich in this country.
Well, there's an old joke, and it's not very funny, is that during market crashes, money returns to its rightful owners. And that's referring to the wealthy, because during times like this, people who don't have a lot of stocks and who will eventually have to sell their stocks to live on, they sell them, and then people who have a lot of cash and who may never have to sell their stocks buy them back at bargain prices. So yes, there is a huge opportunity that this will increase inequality in the United States, which has a lot of causes and a lot of effects. And this is only part of the story. But yes, this can increase inequality.
Is there any sense, Chris Farrell, that some of the efforts that are being taken, some of the policy adaptations that are being made in the $2 trillion relief measure, things like extending unemployment insurance to 1099 people who are self-employed, that kind of a thing, could could change policy going forward outside of the crisis?
I think it will. I think it will definitely change the discussion. And there's sort of a couple of areas where I see this, and two, all involving employment. The first is we've had this ongoing debate, kind of stuck, going nowhere, in terms of paid sick leave. You have a couple of cities have adopted paid sick leave policies, but nothing national. And we stand out among the major industrialized nations as not having paid sick leave. Well, I think all of a sudden, everyone kind of realizes, hey, you know what? Paid sick leave may make a huge difference. And so I think it's going to shift the debate about paid sick leave. The other thing where I think it's going to make a difference is there's a lot of focus on how Europe and the European governments are essentially using their fiscal purse to pay businesses to keep employees on the payroll, to avoid mass unemployment. So the classic example people are talking about right now is Denmark. So Denmark's going to a small business. It says, look, we'll pay 75%. Of your worker's salary, you still have to pay 25%. You have skin in the game. And the deal is you don't lay them off. You may put them on part-time work, and maybe they have some projects. And by the way, the employee, of course, this is Denmark, has to take 5 paid mandatory vacation days. That's what they have to contribute to this deal. But again, it's preventing people from being unemployed. That's a little bit in the what we have in terms of the fiscal stimulus plan that's coming out of Congress right now. But, you know, I think this is going to raise a question of, do you want an unemployment system that keeps people employed rather than tides them over while they're unemployed? And that's going to be a big debate.
A big part of that debate has got to be, Kerry Pechter, health insurance. I mean, laying off all these people means that's my biggest issue in planning for retirement, because my husband and I are different ages, is who's going to cover the health insurance? And it's not simple. What about now that all these people are being laid off? What happens then?
Well, I'd like to pick up on that and on something you said a minute ago about it having this effect beyond the the policy outside of the financial system.
Yeah.
I'm concerned that when this is done and we find that the federal debt is, twice as high as it was beforehand,
right.
that depending on who's managing the debate, they're going to say, oh, well, we have so much debt now, we can't possibly afford universal health care, or we cannot possibly afford to expand Social Security.
Mm.
And other people are going to say, well, the crisis showed us that we're going to need those things more than ever. And so what's going to loom, and it depends on who controls the narrative, is this debate over, is the country now, should the country now go more like Europe, or should we go back towards, or whether we have to pull in, tighten our belts, as Ohio's John Boehner said during the Great Financial Crisis. That's a debate that we're going to have when this is cleared up a little bit.
What do you think, Chris Farrell?
Oh, I think he's absolutely right. And I think that what this whole situation makes clear is just how important, as you mentioned, universal health care. So you're losing your job and your family loses their health insurance. This makes no sense to me, and I think to a lot of people. And then, the concern, Social Security is the bedrock annuity, because it really is an annuity. It's an inflation-adjusted annuity, mm-hmm. and is the bedrock of retirement savings in the United States. And so, yes, I think he's absolutely right. There is going to be a huge debate. Right now, however, in the crisis that we're talking about, I do have to say, Congress has done its job. And then in terms of passing a big fiscal stimulus and the debate about what do we do about the debt and the deficit is down the road.
Are we going to have, I say, as a society, second thoughts about the tax cuts that were put through early on in the Trump administration, Kerry Pechter? I mean, you're talking about the debt, which you're right is $2 trillion. I mean, it's going to be doubled by the end of all this.
Yeah,
and
I have,
we're going to have less revenue coming in.
Yeah, yeah, there's going to be a tax problem in terms of the drop in revenue at a time when the taxes are needed. But let me address the tax situation a little bit and the tax. It depends on how you think about taxes. If George Bush, when he had his tax cut, and I imagine the same kind of thinking drove Donald Trump, was that, you know, it's your money, and the government needs to give it back to you because the government confiscated it from you in the first place. But there's another way of looking at taxes as the taxes are not confiscation of your money. Taxes are kind of a part of the cycle of spending into the economy and then taking money out of the economy because you need to drain out excess. You can't just put money in. So it's depending on how you think about taxes, whether it's part of a person's, a part of what you need to do. A tax cut goes to a larger discussion. I can't really go into it now, but it depends on how you think about taxes in a way.
Mm. Chris Farrell?
Yeah, I mean, one way to think about it, and there are a number of economists, both conservative and liberal, who have looked at tax cuts, and they say, look, they're really not tax cuts. They're really tax increases that have been deferred. If you look at the obligations for Social Security and for Medicare and for health care. And so, yes, I mean, look, to have the tax cuts at a time in the eighth year of a long-term economic expansion, when you want to be paying down your debt and reducing your deficit even further. This is the experience that we're going through right now is why people would say, no, what you need to do is pay down the debt, reduce the deficit, so that when troubled times come, and troubled times always come, you have this firepower, you have these resources to use without some of the negative long-term effects of the kind of debate that Kerry's talking about with, well, can we afford Social Security anymore, which is, in one hand, a ridiculous debate, but he's absolutely right. That's what we're going to end up discussing at some point.
Right. I mean, it's just like what you recommended at the beginning for the individual, you know, the households.
Yeah.
It's the same thing for the nation.
That's right. How do you lower your risk?
Kerry?
No, the nation, this is a fundamental point that people really should hear about. The household, the nation is not like a household. The nation is the opposite of the household. The government, John Boehner was wrong when he said that when the people have to tighten their belts, the government has to tighten its belts.
Okay.
The government has infinite liquidity.
Yeah, but what I'm talking about is the government should have been paying down debt, not lowering taxes.
Not necessarily.
Okay.
Because the government doesn't need to run a surplus or get its debt down in order to be more agile. No matter how much debt it has, there is never any impairment on its ability to, say, send out Social Security checks. It's fundamentally different from a household.
Okay. Then, Kerry, I feel like I'm hearing a couple different things from you, though, is then the debt doesn't matter? This $2 trillion further debt we're going into as a nation doesn't? Or do you think that it changes the discussion, but the fundamental role of the government doesn't change? It's just how we politicize it.
Well, the debt is kind of a wash in the sense that we had a stock market that's 25,000 because the government has all that debt. The debt represents the money that the government spent into the economy but did not take out in taxes or borrowing.
Okay.
It's the mirror. If you look at a chart that shows the amount of wealth in the private hands and the amount of debt that the government carries, it's a one-to-one match.
Well, Chris, we're just about out of time, but Chris Farrell, you want to respond to that?
Well, no, I don't. What he's saying is absolutely right on the one hand. But on the other hand, because there always is on the other hand, mm-hmm. It's the reason why people talk about paying down the debt and the deficit in good times is that you're then making decisions about where government resources are going to. So we're going to hear, just like you said, we can't afford universal health insurance in this country because of the debt and the deficit. And that is simply not true, but it is going to feed into this debate and this discussion that we have going forward. So, yes, enormous firepower. Do it and do it now. But then I think what it does matter is when you take a look at what Denmark is doing in paying employees to stay on the payroll of small businesses, it has hardly any debt and deficit. So there's no concern.
Chris Farrell, senior economics contributor for Marketplace. You hear it every day on 89.7. Chris, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks a lot.
Carrie Pector, editor and publisher for Retirement Income Journal. Carrie, thanks for your time. I really appreciate it.
Happy to be here.
And thanks to everybody else for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.